Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browder. She is Mardrigan Isvandarit DeAndre Myers. I hope I pronounced it right. The new Michael Brown. The St. Louis teenager was fatally shot maybe eight times by an off-duty officer. This has further exacerbated the extreme tension which already exists between the police and black community out there. Here with us on Studio 3 to talk about this and other issues concerning morality and justice are the Reverends Irene Monroe and Emmett Price. Reverend Irene Monroe is a syndicated columnist. Reverend Emmett Price is a professor of music at Northeastern University. Great to see you both.
Thanks for having us back.
Great
Thank
to be
you
here.
Very much for coming in. So over the weekend, as you guys know, there were protesters out in St. Louis, Missouri. They were protesting what Jim was just talking about, the shooting of this young man, this 18-year-old, by the off-duty police officer, white officer, black kid, or black young man, I should say. But this is a little bit dicier because we don't exactly know. He's got a record. The cops say he had a gun. His mother says he had a sandwich. But is this protesting or not?
This is very, very, very dicey. I mean, here's the issue. You cannot have law enforcement officers operating from a sense of fear. Right. Mm-hmm. And this is what's happening now. So there's this over heightened sensitivity that now they're under attack, which could be the case. I mean, I'm not going to argue it's not, but they're operating from a position and perspective of fear, which is not what you want with individuals who are holding guns and who have the authority of the law on their side. So we don't know all the facts about this situation. We do know this young man was 18 years old. That hurts. Regardless of no matter what your perspective is, whether he had an ankle bracelet on, you know, mm-hmm. for being under house arrest, and whether he had previous gun charges, okay, you know, that's an issue. Whether he shot a gun or somebody else shot a gun, you know, that's an issue too. So I understand that the police are operating out of fear, mm-hmm. and that cannot work.
I agree with Emmett. And the other problem is that this distrust that the community has is simply because of over-policing. So when you have distrust in the community and something like this happened, you have a lot of sort of interesting narratives or lies about what really happened in that moment. I'm suspect. Of the young man. Of the young man. That the police in this incident may have been right in the action that they took. But given how community trust is broken, given the legacy of over-policing and the militarization of policing, this is a hard kind of, you know, issue to sort through fact versus fiction.
Well, it's also, there's a political issue. You know how we talk about, the most recent example I can think of is suggesting, what's the name of the woman that just won the MacArthur, who was from GLAAD for
Mary Bonanno?
Yes. How one of her strokes of brilliance on gay marriage was picking the perfect plaintiffs, the perfect, mm-hmm. this should be the face of this issue. I worry that if this Myers young man becomes the face of the issue of white cops abusing black kids, and it comes out that, yeah, he did have a gun, or yes, there were problems, then it is used by those who want to silence the whole debate to sort of taint the whole thing.
I mean, absolutely. Sort of, not only this particular individual, the verdict isn't out about Michael Brown.
Right, the grand jury still.
Because if the photo that we've all seen or the footage we've all seen has not been doctored, This young man, for whatever the reason may be, has indeed committed a crime. So, no, we don't want that to be the iconic image, because it certainly says this is why we need more policing. And it also just maintains an image that when we look at criminality, number one, that's the face of a black man. And it ignores that in black community. Well, it gives this impression that nothing but anarchy and lawlessness reside in the black community when you have hardworking, church-going black folks there.
I mean, part of the problem, and I agree with you, Jim, is I went on Facebook and look at this this site, We Are Darren Wilson, and I was intrigued by
Wilson is the cop who shot Michael Brown, for those who don't recall.
Yeah. Without arms.
Yeah, right. I was intrigued by this because
unarmed, I should say.
There are some very racist and some very inappropriate conversations going on, but there also are conversations of law enforcement officers and their families who are afraid mm-hmm. for the lives of the officers, and to hear them propose their opinions and their perspectives of how they're being, you know, persecuted in their own right, how they're being, kind of victimized by individuals who may not be part of the peaceful protesters, but may be some of the extremists.
But Emmett, though, I think there's a bigger issue here, and it's this whole notion of being an oppressed Caucasian. And there's a book out. I had to read this. It's by Michael Kimmel, who's a sociologist. And the book is titled Angry White Men, American Masculinity at the End of the Era. And the interesting thing that he talks about, and I thought was really wonderful, that on election night, after Obama was announced as the winner, our boy, Bill O'Reilly, he lamented that he no longer lives in a traditional America. So the question is that then if Kimmel's premise is correct, then what are white men angry about? And when we see folks that are absolutely in support of Darren Wilson without any evidence of who's guilty in this horrible tragedy, he came up with some examples. One is that with the browning of America, we're also seeing some economic and social and political shifts going on. That's number one. And with white males, we're seeing a downward mobility. But he also said this that I thought was really, really interesting. He says that this group of white men are called aggrieved. They're suffering from what's called aggrieved entitlement, a sense that those benefits that white men believe were their birthright are now just snatched away.
Can I tell you something? This guy, you had to pay for this book?
I know.
Like, you needed to know that
the attitude is the white
man in America, of which I am one, those people took our job. Those women, those blacks, those Latinos,
well,
those are our jobs.
That.
Those are our positions of power.
I've always thought it was mano a mano. White guys in general are intimidated by black men, especially black men that are more virile than they are. And besides which, the black guy's taking over all the sports teams. And it's really
the white guys
kicking on the teams anymore.
But I don't agree with that. I think that it's very, very, it's too easy to make it black and white. Because because when I look at like small towns and they have the eruption of skinheads and stuff, I mean, these are kids that are socially isolated, culturally alienation. There's no economy, you know, in these communities. And I think that what happens is it makes me think of the busing incident when we look at South Boston and Roxbury. It's very easy to look at that thing very black and white and not look at nuance, what's happening. And these are disenfranchised people. And I just think that we have to look at economic disparity that give rise to this kind of crazy behavior that we only look at it through a racial
lens. So wait a second. So does that explain what you just described, Irene Monroe? Does that explain the fans outside the St. Louis, San Francisco game? We just discussed this with Shira Springer from the Globe, chanting, "Let's go, Darren," as in the shooter, in the face of the almost all black protesters.
Oh, no, they straight up bigots.
How about this
bigots.
One? We're the ones who gave you all the freedoms that you have. And then another female Cardinals fan. Yeah, another woman chanting, "Africa, Africa, Africa," at the protesters. I mean, it is staggering, but let's not go with the outliers. Let's come back to Boston if we can for a minute. Civil Liberties Union put out a study last week that has been more than controversial. Looked at these FIOs, frisks, investigations, stops, that sort of thing. It's sort of a compendium of things from 2007 to 2010. And the statistic that they trumpeted the most, which, by the way, now is not being used very much because I think many people feel it didn't give a true picture, is that 63% of these stops were of black men. Mm-hmm. Only 24% of the population are black men. Now, the controversy came out, starting with you, Emmett Price, is when the Civil Liberties Union described this not just as racial disparity, which it clearly is, any way you look at this study, but that there was racial bias. And the two authors of the report, one from Rutgers and Harvard and the other one, I think, from NYU, I'm not sure, said, no, that's a jump. You can clearly say racial disparity. You cannot draw the conclusion that the data we've pulled together shows bias on the part of the police. And by the way, let me emphasize again, the police prior to Evans becoming commissioner and Walsh becoming the mayor. What's your take on this controversy back here at home, Emmett Price?
Well, I think there's a defensive measure because we don't want to project that things are out of whack and that things are chaotic. So let's be clear that, and this is the kind of the articulation of the report, let's be clear that the data was from 2007 and 2010, and between the years 2010 and 2014, going on 2015, the Boston Police Department has made great strides and made great, you know, moves forward in terms of progress to eradicate, if not to stall, some of this data. One, with bringing, you know, Chief William Gross on as the number two in command of Police Department.
Highest ranking black in the police department.
Absolutely. As well as bringing in some new recruits and creating new opportunities for people to take exams to move up and to be promoted within the department. That being said, if you talk to the young people on the street, they still feel that they're being not only patronized, but they're being falsely accused of different things that go on because they look a certain way.
That's right.
And so, again, when you have police who are operating from a position of fear, you're clearly going to go after those who seem to be able to do more harm than others.
That's right. I mean, a classic example, I mean, we don't— Trayvon Martin, you're wearing a hoodie or you're wearing your pants below your belt. It is an iconic image that is the image of criminality. But there's a bigger problem. I don't care if you put a blue person, you know, running Boston or urban police departments. You have to change the culture. And in changing the culture, you really have to address really implicit and explicit forms of racism, how that plays out. So I'll give you a classic example here in Cambridge. Some young, you know, brothers were coming from a ball game at Cambridge Ringe in Latin, and, you know, they were rather animated, and of course they had their hoodies and the way brothers swagger and all this other stuff. And it was amazing how the cops rolled up on these boys, didn't stop them, but their demeanor changed. And what it told me is that their parents gave them that talk, that when the cops come, if you're being loud or perceived to be loud, because we know of this case where this white man shot an African-American brother simply because he and his cronies were playing the music too loud and stuff. So, I mean, those are the things that we have to work on, that I don't care who you put in there. If you don't change the culture of the place, you're just reinscribing the same maladies that you're purporting to get rid of.
Yeah. I think there's also this unease. It reminds me in a way of Ebola, even though probably we're going to be okay here in Boston. When you hear about these things happening around the country, people get nervous. And if I were a mother in Roxbury with a 6'2" son who was 17 years old, I would be hearing about Michael Brown. I would be hearing about Trayvon Martin and thinking,
I'd cry every day.
As a million mothers do, this could be my kid just walk into job and somebody makes a mistake and bang, he's gone.
I mean, both mothers and fathers, right?
Yeah, fathers. I'm sorry, I should have included the fathers.
And so even with the Ebola thing, there have been numerous examples of people of African descent walking into restaurants and people getting up in haste leave the restaurant.
And like at Whole Foods, which is an open bar. I can't tell you to experience this here in Cambridge. And Jim,
don't
I didn't
tell
see
me.
You the other
Wait
day.
Wait a second. I want to hear this
tell
story.
Me.
Go ahead.
Okay.
So people are
looking at you at the hot bar?
I mean, and I'm thinking now, okay. And it was very, very interesting. They came out with some new, you know, fresh, you know, assortments of foods and stuff.
Yes, I know
and
very
I,
well.
And listen, didn't cough.
Wait, I'm dying to hear. What,
Just stroll over there. Just stroll over there. And it was amazing. You think I would have bad breath, bad odor.
People walk. Walked away?
Moved
no,
away.
They did not.
Yes, they did.
The Red Sea parted for
okay,
Irene.
Absolutely. Now,
oh, my God.
I like to think that, you know, it's because I arrived, and of course, I should have first choosing of stuff.
Can
but
I tell
that,
Irene,
you, Irene,
know, now you're hitting it. I have elbowed people out of the way, black and white, at
okay,
the hot food bar.
Okay,
I want to be
that's
clear.
Right. That's right.
At Whole Foods
Party
Park.
Of the Sea.
Can we stay on this thing for a second?
Party of the Sea.
But it seems to me... If you recall, when Marty Walsh was elected, and he was still the mayor-elect, he said, the first thing I'm going to deal with on day one, which he did, is inner-city violence.
Yes.
And, you know, it's not exactly popular with a typical middle-class white voter, but it's something that mattered to him. And I think it matters a lot if what comes out of this report is what you both say is, let's face it, there's a culture that needs addressing, which I believe Walsh and Evans would both acknowledge exists, or... what the Civil Liberties Union, which I generally have huge respect for, I should say, where that there is intentional racial bias here. And I think that difference does matter, at least from my reading of the data from this report. That wasn't proven. What was proven is there are racial disparities, which proves that there is a cultural issue which needs some serious addressing. Yes. I mean, is that a fair statement? I agree with you.
And for me, that's hopeful because although climate change and culture change takes time, we do have an understanding of how to do it. I mean, in different universities and different corporations, you have diversity and inclusion officers whose main responsibility is to change the climate and the culture. And so I think we have to move in that direction to figure out what it should look like and then systematically create a pathway to get there.
Yeah, but I think what's missing around the table, I totally agree with you, Emmett, on this, but I think what's missing is the very disenfranchised young men and women who are being targeted, that if you want the kind of sea change you want, it's wonderful to have us ministers and sociologists and academicians there, but you got to really bring the kids in and say, what is it that we are doing? How do we misread you constantly? And see, the thing is that as much as we want to have this race talk, I think that this might be one of the ways that we can have that. Have it not with me and Emmett and you, but have it with a younger generation.
I agree with that. Yeah.
Well, you know what I always find I don't understand about the stories like these is, you know, the cops are always talking about, Evans is too, about community policing and talking about the fact that they know who the bad actors are, and there's a very small number of them because Boston's a relatively small town.
A few hundred, they usually
yeah,
say.
So yeah, so if they know who the few hundred bad actors are, why are they after everybody else? That's what I don't.
I mean, you know what's funny about that, and I've spent some time with some police detectives and whatnot, and yes, they do know who the bad apples are. The problem is they don't have a control over the sphere of influence of those bad apples.
That's right.
And
oh,
so
I see.
You have this thing where young children and young adults and whatnot are very impressionable, and it only takes one bad decision to create havoc in somebody's, you know, life and somebody's neighborhood.
And communities, rightly or wrongly, will protect them. And part of protecting them is not because they are really upholding this egregious behavior that they're certainly exhibiting. It's again because they're afraid to let the police department correct them. We're afraid of the penal system. It's sort of like, let us try to do it as best as we can with ministers and extended family than to let the police do it. Mm-hmm. Because our interest is more invested in rehabbing this individual.
Yeah.
And see, one of the problems with our penal system that they need to understand and to make a distinction between teaching a lesson and ruining a life. And that's the tension and balance that we're holding. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so here's that moment that everybody's waiting for, particularly Emmett Price. This is the moment where I turn to Reverend Irene Monroe and ask, will you acknowledge progress? And here is this week's progress, at least according to some of us. You know this two-week meeting of the bishops, the synod, as they call it? Well, listen to what the report on the first week of this closed-door thing, don't smirk yet, we'll just wait till I'm done here.
Okay.
Said that I'll read you from the AP story. Catholic bishops showed unprecedented openness Monday to accepting the real lives of many Catholics today, saying gays had gifts to offer the church and should be accepted, and that there were, quote, positive aspects to a couple living together without being married. Now, by the way, they did not embrace gay marriage. It's still off the table. But again, let me leave it to you. So is this not significant progress, Irene Monroe?
Don't forget contraception.
Oh, that's right. And what was the line? Say the line on contraception here.
Well, they're applying something called the law of gradualness to contraception and other family situations. I'm not sure what the law of gradualness really means. If that means that you gradually have sex or you gradually
and
use
who does
contraception.
Who gradually does it?
But it's exactly. But it sounded like there was some reconsideration of the outright ban on contraception. So.
Okay, so is that progress or not, Irene Monroe?
Okay, last week on a scale of 5, I gave our Pope a 2.
Okay.
I give him a 2.25.
Okay. That's pretty generous.
Absolutely.
We'll hear from you, Emmett, in a minute. Why is that?
It's a robust quarter.
Robust
and,
quarter.
It really, really is. And I will say that, yes, he is moving towards healing the church. He's very much about we're stepping into to the modern family of today. He's using conciliatory
language.
They
all watch Modern Family. Do you know that during the synod?
Probably.
They took a break and they...
Right. He's using conciliatory language to in many ways, gradually move church policy. But absolutely, let me just say this because I know Emmett is going to give a glowing response. Let me say what my pastor used to say to me when I would show him my report card and I got a D in conduct. He would say this from an F.
He used a D or an F
in conduct?
Yeah, because
they said
said so I talked. So did I, by
yeah,
the way.
They said I talked a lot. I don't quite get that.
I had not noticed that.
But this is what my pastor, when I moved from an F to D, he said this, and this is what I say about the Pope. It ain't what it ought to be, but thank God it ain't what it used to be.
That's perfect.
Okay, that's an amen.
That's an amen.
Thank you very much.
Okay, Emma, take it away.
I mean, this is huge.
I mean, just the tone
of this thing, right? I mean, for them to even talk about, you know, what they use the word, civil weddings, right?
Yes.
They use the word gay partnerships,
yes.
Right? You know, I mean, just the tone of the fact that they're having this conversation and moving towards a more progressive manner. This is awesome.
I'm sickening.
This is awesome.
Premarital sex.
Okay, but let me
seem to be.
Let's stay on the gay thing. Hold on. Let me read this. The bishop said gays had, quote, gifts and qualities to offer and asked rhetorically if the church was ready to provide them a welcoming place, quote, accepting and valuing their sexual orientation. By the way, calling it orientation, too.
Without compromising
Catholic doctrine
But
progress, as I think you probably have written or spoken about, sometimes takes a while. Who's that, your pastor? Is that who was mm-hmm. you were talking about before? Mm-hmm. Forget your position. What would your pastor's reaction to this be? Don't you think he'd be a little bit more?
Oh, he would be ecstatic. He'd be like Emmett.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Oh, he'd be like Emmett, but he's heterosexual, you know? And so too is Emmett. But let me just say this. I mean, yes, we can applaud that. Yes, he used the gay word, but there are a lot of things there's an undercurrent here. One is trying to clean up the church sex scandal, because the perception of it was that the pedophiles were all gay, and the real issue was it wasn't until young boys were talking about being raped that the church ever did anything about sexual abuse, because historically, you know, pastors have, you know, gay priests have been molesting children.
By the way,
children.
Just on that point, a good friend of Marjorie's and mine, who was a survivor here, always points out that what is not said in these conversations, which is where you're going, a third of the survivors mm-hmm. of the Catholic sexual abuse thing
were young girls.
That's right. So much for the pedophiles would go after girls and boys.
Yes.
That's right. And it got lost in the narrative because of giving the homophobia. But an interesting thing, and I give the Pope this, because when they asked him, well, what do you think about, you know, about gays and lesbians? And he says, who am I to judge? And the reason being is that the Catholic Church is gay. He talked about an aggressive gay lobby.
The gay mafia that is
in the church. So that has a lot to do with pushing the church forward, because you would lose this wonderful gift and talent that the gay Catholics offer. But let's not forget this too.
Can they come out of the closet, do you think, now, these gay bishops?
I hope they do.
Once the Pope has a more open and welcoming.
Some of them are out with their robes. They're actually dresses, but nonetheless, that's another discussion for another time.
My goodness.
But the other thing we got to realize is that the purpose of getting this particular Pope has a lot to do with expanding what it means to be a Catholic today.
Exactly.
Which is why it's so exciting. Because he's doing what he said he was going to do.
Let's talk about the money. The coffers are empty. They've lost that conservative Catholic person. So they have to open it up to women, to LGBT people. Let's not forget that the Catholic Church is a business. And so just like what the Episcopal Church had to do, once your ranks shrink, you got to find another demographic group, and we are willing to walk in.
Now, let me just say that we at cruxnow.com at the Boston Globe be all over the
story.
And
I love you, by the way. I love your new job.
Crux Now will be leaving no stone unturned in the examination of what exactly is going on
in that synod,
which I used to call synod for about 20 years. No, it's not synod, it's synod.
But the trickle-down impact of this, it seems to me, I don't know if we discussed it with you or discussed it with some of our political panelist types, is it seems to me that when the Pope is leading a conversation that shows great 2.25 grade on a scale of 1 to 5, and much greater acceptance and openness, I think it has an impact on everything from Supreme Court justices to individual Congress people. And I don't mean, by the way, you're talking about motive a minute ago, where, you know, in terms of why the church is doing this. I don't really care what the motive is of elected officials in the Supreme. It gives them cover. It's
oh,
no longer
the
seen
high court as justices
that's
are Catholic.
Right.
I understand
that's
that.
Right.
And
absolutely.
So, and
yeah.
So, I mean, if the Pope is doing a who am I to judge kind of thing, not just on that plane, but in the synod, it seems to me it does provide a place for a lot of recalcitrant public officials.
I totally
to
agree
move.
With you. So if he's going to use this stance, who am I to judge when he is talking about gays and lesbians?
Well, you just then did judge. You gave him a 2.25.
Okay, he needs to also then make a very open statement, an affirmative statement about women in the Catholic Church.
I agree with that. I agree.
And stuff. And so basically, to be quite honest, if you want to look at the demographic group, more women attend church than men. So to keep women in ecclesiastical hostage because you don't think that we should ascend to the priesthood, he gets two and a quarter.
Except when you know, when you look at what Catholics are worried about, I regret to say the women thing is way down. It's much more the sex abuse thing.
Because you feel we can't fight it. Well, listen,
and
it has more to do with the fact that his ears is just as deaf tone to it.
Well, I think that's coming.
I think that's coming.
Oh. So I'm not speaking to the rest of you for the remaining of the show.
Well, we'll pray for you this week then.
Okay.
Thank you. So it was a 2.25 following a 2. So I would call that progress. Great to see you both. Thank you.
Absolutely great to see you both.
Irene jumps out of the chair. I've never seen her. We don't have any guests. We have no guest who is out of here faster.
As soon as she knows the conversation's over,
she's in her car. We haven't even said thank you
yet to this woman. I'm going to Whole Foods for lunch.
Good.
Hopefully I won't be hard to see.
Yeah,
good to see you
nobody
both.
Moves away from you
at
the hot
so
bar. That would really
I
be
find
just
that a little
kill
hard
me.
To believe, but okay.
Okay. Reverend Irene Monroe is a syndicated columnist. You can find her at the Huffington Post and Bay Windows. Reverend Emmett Price is a professor of music at Northeastern University. His latest book is The Black Church and Hip-Hop Culture Toward Bridging the Generational Divide. Irene Monroe and Emmett Price, always great to talk to you guys. And coming up, we continue our ballot question explainers with a focus on question number 1, whether or not to repeal the indexing of the gas tax. That is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.